Gamblers have placed their final bets at the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The casino officially shut down after a month-long labor dispute with its workers. WHYY's Joe Hernandez was there today when the doors closed for good.
What do we want? When do we want it?
Workers were still striking outside the Taj Mahal just before it closed. There wasn't going to be an 11th-hour contract agreement, but they kept chanting and beating their drums anyway. Bob McDevitt runs the union Unite Here Local 54, which represented about 1,000 Taj Mahal workers.
I've worked at 4 properties in Atlantic City as a worker, and this is the 4th one to close.
McDevitt says workers went on strike over their health and pension benefits, which new owner Carl Icahn cut when he took control of the casino. Icahn says he had to shut down the Taj Mahal because it was losing money and negotiations were going nowhere. McDevitt disagrees.
There is no way that Carl Icahn made the decision based upon finances. This was an attack on workers who stood up to him.
Tina Condos was a cocktail waitress on the casino floor who started working at the Taj the day it opened 26 years ago. She says casino workers are the backbone of Atlantic City, and firing almost 3,000 of them is going to have ripple effects.
We're your mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers. We're your family. We are your friends. We are the people that support this local community. Because if we don't work, our community doesn't work. It's a domino effect. This community depends solely on the casinos. And that is not these workers' fault.
Donald Trump opened the casino in 1990 and filed for bankruptcy a year later. He no longer owns the Taj Mahal. Unhappy workers weren't the only ones there when the doors finally closed. A few last-minute gamblers were throwing the dice one last time. Atlantic City resident Michael Gesualdo lives across the street from the Taj. He says he'll miss everything about it.
Food, atmosphere, living, life. Steel Pier, come on, man. It's the center of the universe.
That universe has contracted considerably. The Taj is the 5th casino to close in Atlantic City in 3 years. Laid-off workers will be able to use a resource center offered by the union while they figure out what's next. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Questions over the country's energy future surfaced during last night's presidential debate. It was a surprising 5 minutes of policy discussion and a tense debate focusing on character assassination. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on how the facts stacked up to the candidates' comments on energy.
The second to the last question came from an undecided voter named Ken Bone, who found unexpected popularity on social media and later said the debate felt like watching his parents fight. Here was his question.
What steps will your energy policy take to meet our energy needs while at the same time remaining environmentally friendly and minimizing job loss?
This really is the perfect question for anyone running for office right now. How do we combat climate change, keep the lights burning, and not fire people who have few other prospects for good-paying jobs? Remember, coal miners make an average $50,000 a year. Compare that to the average wage making, say, semiconductors for solar installations, which is about $32,000 a year. Trump went first, saying energy is under siege from the Environmental Protection Agency. But much of what Trump passed off as facts don't really hold up to scrutiny.
There is a thing called clean coal. Coal will last for 1,000 years in this country.
Yes, there is a thing called clean coal. It means using technology to capture the carbon dioxide at the power plant before it gets released into the atmosphere, and then burying it underground. It's a process that's still very expensive and not economical for all but a few power plants. And U.S. coal won't last for 1,000 years at our current rate of consumption. The Energy Information Administration projects the U.S. has about 250 years worth of coal, not 1,000. Coal production has dropped by 36% since President Obama took office. Coal companies are declaring bankruptcies while power plants switch to burning natural gas. And although Obama's clean power plan would force even more coal plants to shut down, economics has had more to do with coal's recent decline than environmental regulations. coal just can't compete with cheaper natural gas. Still, Trump says he will bring back coal.
The EPA is so restrictive that they are putting our energy companies out of business. And all you have to do is go to a great place like West Virginia or places like Pennsylvania, and you see what they're doing to the people, miners and others in the energy business. It's a disgrace.
Oil and gas producers in places like Pennsylvania saw enormous success during the Obama administration. A recent slowdown in production is a result of the typical boom and bust cycles. The companies produced so much natural gas in places like Pennsylvania that prices dropped to record lows, forcing slowdowns in drilling and layoffs. Clinton's energy policy is a stark contrast to Trump's. She wants to increase solar energy production by 700% in 4 years. And unlike Trump, she wants to tackle climate change. During the debate, Clinton's comments did not raise any red flags for fact checkers, except this.
We are now, for the first time ever, energy independent.
That's not true. The U.S. continues to import more oil than it exports, primarily from Canada, but also Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Mexico, and Colombia. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The annual call goes out to anyone with a plan to strengthen Philadelphia by attracting and retaining talented people, expanding economic opportunity, and/or creating a culture of civic engagement. Joining me to explain and help make the appeal is Patrick Morgan, Philadelphia Program Director for the Knight Foundation. Patrick, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
So the clock is ticking. The Knight Cities Challenge just started today, and it goes through November 3rd.
That's absolutely right. And the Knight Foundation, the national foundation with deep local roots here in Philly, started by the Knight brothers who own newspapers here in Philadelphia, is looking for Philadelphia's best ideas to make Philadelphia and all of our Knight communities actually successful. And the levers that we use to kind of define success are, as you said, attracting and retaining talent, providing economic opportunity, and creating a culture of civic engagement. So the Knight Cities Challenge is an open call that we make available $5 million for our 26 communities across the country. And again, the only real stipulations are you can apply from anywhere. You can have any idea that, again, is tied towards the outcomes of advancing opportunity, engagement, and talent. And it has to benefit one or more of our 26 Knight communities. And also, we want to be able to not just learn from the idea, but quite frankly, to spread the idea out through our communities and our broader national network.
Because clearly many of the ideas that might resonate here could also apply to some of the other 25 communities that Knight is representing as well.
That's absolutely right. And we have a number of previous winners who did touch on a few of our other Knight cities and Knight communities. For example, the Urban Consulate was a winner from last year, and that takes place in Philadelphia, Detroit, and New Orleans. And the concept there is, how do you bring together people who are visiting a city and existing residents? So in Philadelphia, what that looks like, the Urban Consulate is actually based in a hotel lobby. So they'll do different events, different meetups that will appeal not only to local Philadelphians, but, you know, people who are visiting the city and just love cities and will hopefully attend this in their hotel lobby and get a robust conversation going.
Speak to the piece that prioritizes both attracting and retaining key personnel in Philadelphia.
So, I mean, I think one of the winners that would best describe that would be the Institute for Hip Hop Entrepreneurship. And that was last year's winner.
Little Giant Creative.
Little Giant Creative, yes, is actually a for-profit organization. It is a nine-month program for 30 people. They've had 300 applicants, and it's really looking at using the lens of hip-hop to bring in people and help them with business development, entrepreneurial skills, who, quite frankly, maybe not have been connected to those skills previously.
Do the ideas and applications have to come in the form of a well-conceived grant application, or can anybody put pen to paper or hit a keyboard and submit?
Well, it's hit a keyboard, and it's unique compared to a traditional foundation application in that this initial application is only 300 words. If you are go from an applicant to a finalist. Now, obviously, you know, you're going to have to provide some more words than 300. You're going to have to flesh that out. But this initial application, again, very unique if you look at how other foundations would do this. It's 300 words. So given that, the advice that I typically give to people is be clear, be concise. There's not a lot of room for jargon in 300 words.
Patrick, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Great. Thanks so much, Dave.
Patrick Morgan is Philadelphia Program Director for the Knight Foundation. And this disclosure, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation supports WHYY. Still ahead this evening, Deja Frischman was trying to escape from a future she desperately did not want.
I don't want to have to be that mom that has to work two jobs and can't, you know, spend time with her child and my son. I love him. He's a blessing. I want to be able to watch him grow.
Deja is part of a program in Allentown that helps once homeless parents go through school. NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. In Allentown, Pennsylvania, there's a red brick building with a green door. 12 families live there. They're almost all single moms with kids, and they were all at one point homeless. They're part of a 2-year-long program called Turner Street that's intended to give these families everything they need to pull themselves out of poverty. The program is one of thousands across the country that operate under a certain assumption that many who end up homeless don't know how to take care of themselves and need to be taught. This idea has fallen out of favor with the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. Keystone Crossroads reporter Marielle Segura has been following three women since January as they make their way through Turner Street. In a 3-part series, she'll tell us their stories and examine a question that the program raises. When people are homeless, how much help do they need?
On a January afternoon, Michelle Andrews put her infant son in a carrier car seat, gathered her two daughters, and hurried out the door of their apartment.
They're like, why are we running through the snow, like hiding? And I'm like, we're just playing hide and seek.
They wandered around Allentown for hours.
And I was scared to call my family because the one thing he would always say is whoever you call for help, that he would hurt them.
He was her partner at the time, and she says he was abusive. Michelle spent the next year renting out rundown rooms in Allentown. And then, against the odds, she started college classes and enrolled in a program called Turner Street. Most government-funded housing programs provide a place to live, but nothing more. Turner Street is different. It's called transitional housing, and it offers affordable apartments to parents who are in school full-time. Residents also get a caseworker, free food, household items, and after 2 years, a voucher for a private apartment. In exchange, they have to follow strict rules and keep up their grades in school. Michelle, who's 28 now, remembers her move-in day.
I, like, literally fell to my knees and was crying, and the lady was like, all right, we gotta, like, sign the lease, like, the lady for the housing.
The goal of the Turner Street program is to help residents become self-sufficient. Alan Jennings is the director of the Community Action Committee of the Lehigh Valley, the nonprofit that runs Turner Street. And he says self-sufficiency comes down to getting vocational training or a college degree.
We want to give them the time and the space to be able to do that so at the end they can get a job that's meaningful, that pays the bills, and hopefully they'll never be in crisis again.
Deja Frischman's crisis came early. She got pregnant in March of her junior year of high school. She and her son's father had been dating for about a month. They fell in love fast.
We didn't talk about having a baby, but I don't know if I would call it a mistake either. Like, we just kind of let it happen.
Deja dropped out of school, and things went sour with her ex. So she moved around, crashing with her mom, her grandmother, and a friend.
It was just too much, and it's like, that's too many different faces, too many different homes, too many different beds. Like, I can't have my son living like that.
She moved into the program's shelter and then applied for a spot at Turner Street. She saw it as an escape from a future she desperately didn't want.
I don't want to have to be that mom that has to work two jobs and can't, you know, spend time with her child and my son. I love him. He's a blessing. I want to be able to watch him grow.
There was no guarantee she'd get in. Government housing assistance is typically awarded based on a person's income. If you're under the threshold, you get on a wait list and hope a spot opens up. But transitional housing programs are more exclusive, with a lot of requirements and often an interview process to see if you're worthy. Alan Jennings again.
I've said many times, you can't help somebody that doesn't want to help themselves. And so, you know, the idea here is to put the resources that we can into people who we think can benefit and, you know, hope and pray that it indeed does make that difference.
This approach is the opposite of the federal government's current policy on homelessness called Housing First, which says everyone is ready for a home, regardless of his or her situation. The government says providing housing without other services is usually cheaper and more effective. In fall 2015, Deja moved into Turner Street with her one-year-old son, Omari. Her plan was to get her GED and start college classes in Allentown. Within a few days, she'd gotten two violations. At Turner Street, there's a system where if you get four violations, the program can, and often will, ask you to leave. You can get them for a lot of things: drinking alcohol, doing drugs, missing a meeting, even having a messy apartment. Alan Jennings says the program holds the residents to these high standards because when people who've been homeless are given housing and nothing else, it doesn't always work out so well.
We end up with people trashing apartments. They might not pay their rent. They might be noisy. They might not be keeping their place clean. They get cockroaches.
There's a paternalism to programs like Turner Street, an idea that if you ended up homeless, you don't know how to take care of yourself, and it's the program's job to teach you. Deja's two violations for leaving food in her old fridge and for missing a meeting wouldn't be her last. Kira Cornwell moved into Turner Street around the same time as Deja. Her life unraveled when she lost her job at the Lehigh Valley Business Journal and her car broke down. She enrolled in classes at Penn State's Lehigh Valley campus. But when her unemployment benefits ran out and she couldn't pay her rent, she and her four-year-old son, Martin, got evicted. Then a counselor at school told her about Turner Street, and she got in.
And it was one of the best feelings of my life to know that my son was not going to be homeless.
Kira moved into the program's shelter to wait for her apartment to open up. Like Michelle, she cried a lot that day, but they weren't happy tears.
And I felt so ashamed of myself because I felt I could do better, and I felt like I failed Marty in so many ways.
Kira and Martin moved into their new apartment in November 2015. Getting into Turner Street was a new beginning for Michelle, Deja, and Kira, but the road ahead wouldn't be easy. In our next installment, we'll find out how the Turner Street program helped them toward their goals, what got in the way, and why programs like Turner Street may soon be a thing of the past. Marielle Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. We'll have part two in our series on the Turner Street program tomorrow evening. Expecting a package? Astronauts aboard ISS are looking forward to opening a pretty big box of goodies. Let's look at the packing list with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, it's been a long time coming, this resupply mission.
It's NASA that's providing material supplies, astronauts, along with Roscosmos doing the same thing, the Russian counterpart, and also SpaceX and Orbital Sciences. Orbital Sciences had a hiccup in October of 2014 when its resupply mission to International Space Station failed on liftoff. It was a catastrophic explosion. Those problems have been solved, and this is Orbital Sciences picking up where they left off.
So what's the range of products?
There are foodstuffs, there's medical supplies, there's mechanical equipment, there are experiments that are going. All manner of things, expendables, that could be used aboard a space station. Now, if you might think that because Orbital Sciences hasn't been there since October 2014, they've been running short on items, not the case at all, because the Russian Space Agency and SpaceX have been resupplying International Space Station on regular schedules, so they have enough supplies for probably another one or two launch window missing the launch window of supplies, before there's any real critical shortage of anything.
Of course, what goes up must come down, and it's not too early to anticipate a Chinese craft coming back to Earth.
Yeah, that's right. China actually has two space stations in orbit now, Tiangong-1 and Tiangong-2. makes sense. Tiangong-1 has run into a problem with its telemetry, its communication system. The operators on the ground in China can no longer communicate with it, so they can't ask it to boost itself back up into orbit. It's expected now that Tiangong-1's orbit will decay completely sometime in mid to late 2017. However, there's still a chance for us to actually see the Chinese space station as it flies over Philadelphia as well. And turns out there's a sighting this week. October 14th, we'll be able to see it at 7:30 p.m. in the evening, 46 degrees up above the south-southeastern horizon. Now, as it turns out, the other one, Tiangong-2, is also visible that same day, the 14th, but at 5:40 in the morning, it's up a bit higher, 72 degrees up, and it's in the north-northwest. Let's keep our fingers crossed for clear weather.
Lastly, let's look to the calendar. Plenty of dates of note in October.
October is a landmark month for all sorts of anniversaries. NASA celebrates its 58th year of exploration this month, but probably even outshadowing that, and one that led to the founding of NASA, is the 59th anniversary of the first artificial satellite, Sputnik. That was in 1957 when the Soviet Union launched this object into space and just startled everyone. It's the first time an artificial satellite had ever been launched, and it really was the mark of a major step up in our consideration of the threat of the Soviet Union, because now they had a higher platform above us that could possibly have been used for an attack on the United States, although we have to remember that the Sputnik was actually very, very small, very experimental, and could do no more than just send a signal. So that was the opening of the door to the beginning of the race into space between the United States and Russia.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Bitz, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, time.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.